Jonathan Weiler, how are you?
Good, Matt Andrews. How are you?
I'm great. This is good. First and last name. So we need to be a little more formal in this show. And the show is the Agony of Defeat podcast. And my name is Matt Andrews, and I'm a professor of history here at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
And I'm Jonathan Weiler, a professor of global studies
at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
And more to the point, we both teach courses and are very interested in sports and politics. I do U.S. sports and politics. What do you do, Jonathan?
I do globalization and sports.
There we go. And we're going to talk about a global figure today, O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson died last week, and Jonathan and I instantly texted at each other. And we had an idea. I don't even remember what it was. But we said, let's talk about O.J. O.J. is a big deal in our lives, so we want to deal with that. But Jonathan, before we get there, can I tell you about a book I'm reading?
Please.
I'm reading a great book. I may have recommended it to you, by Michael McCambridge. He wrote a great book about the NFL called America's Game, which I really like. But he's got a new book out called The Big Time, How the 1970s Transformed Sports in America.
Oh.
And it's a big, sprawling book.
Man, I feel like you and I talked about writing a book like that at one point.
I think we did.
So he beat us to it.
It's We would have probably had a little more structure to our book.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong, I love it. I'm recommending it to people. It's a big, sprawling book, and it's the NFL. What I really like about it is a ton of stuff on women's sports. A lot of stuff about the AIAW and their battles with the NCAA. And so I think he's really sensitive to those very important topics. But so I'm reading this 700-page book, and there's this brief paragraph about something from the late 1970s. And I'm thinking to myself, God, that kind of sounds familiar, but I can't really place it. He tells the story of something called sports phone.
Yes.
Okay. So you know sports phone.
I do.
Okay. Tell me about sports phone. Educate our listeners about what sports phone is.
The little ditty that accompanied ads for sports phone is coming back to me. Forgive my singing on live on the podcast, but get all the sports news instantly. Dial 976-1313.
So you remember the actual sports phone number.
I do.
So what would happen if you dialed this?
So what would happen is you would dial the number and it would update every few hours. You were calling a tape recorder, basically.
Okay.
And it would give you the updated scores for that day's games.
Was this push button phones? Was this
dial
phones?
We had in my house the rotary phone. I'm making a dialing motion now.
So was it dial 5 if you want baseball? Dial 6
so
if you want.
So my memory is that you just dialed the number and it just dumped some sports information.
All the scores.
And
Mets 4, Reds 2.
We have to remind our audience
that
in the 1970s, there was an instantaneous information every single millisecond of every day.
Not even close.
You had 11 o'clock local news.
Right.
You could listen to radio updates every so often.
And on the 11 o'clock news, maybe they tell you about 5 scores.
Yeah. But otherwise, like if you were really hungry for a score in the moment.
Right.
This was,
as in if you were a gambler or if you were a 7-year-old boy.
A very quick anecdote. When I was 12 years old in 1978 at my buddy Steve's older sister's Sweet 16 party down on the pier in New York City, this was the year that Ron Guidry, this great Yankee pitcher, was having this historically great
Louisiana Lightning.
Louisiana Lightning won 25 games that year. And he had not lost a game yet. This was mid-June. So my friend Steve, we're like at the party and we go to a payphone. We call sports phone and Steve is listening to the phone.
Our listeners don't know what a payphone is either. You would put a dime into
a
machine
and then
you could call someone.
So Steve is like making all these incredulous faces and I'm like, what happened? No hitter? Did he lose? And he gets off the phone and he just set the American League record for a left-hander. He struck out 18 California Angels.
Whoa, wow.
So this is my great memory of sports phone.
So you got more than just scores. You got
some
statistics.
Yeah. depending
something notable
on,
happened. This guy hit
correct,
a couple of
correct.
Home runs. Yeah. And then I guess SportsCenter came along. I mean, it probably seemed like a good investment at the time.
Right. That's
SportsCenter
right.
comes along
within
two
the next
years later.
Yeah, ESPN goes on the air in 1979.
So SportsCenter was a great idea at the time.
At the time and was quickly supplanted. Yes.
Okay. I just knew yeah. that you would know about SportsCenter. And it rings a bell, but I don't think I ever actually called the
very funny.
Called
very
the
funny.
Number. All right. Yeah. Very good.
Okay.
All right. So two from the trivial to a big deal. O.J. Simpson died last week at the age of, remind me, what was he?
He was 76.
76 years old.
Died of cancer.
Yeah, it is
to
interesting how the headlines, his family says.
Yes.
For
right.
Was there a minute in your mind where you thought, no, he's not really dead? Like, this is just the story, and OJ's going golfing in the Philippines or something. I think he's actually dead.
Yeah, I do too.
And OJ, I was struck by reading these obituaries, and everyone kept saying he has such a conflicting and complicated legacy. And I don't know if anything's conflicting about it. There are just so many legacies mm-hmm. of OJ mm-hmm. Simpson. He was so meaningful in so many ways. Famous and infamous in so many ways. I'm not sure there's another person in American culture in the last half century that is so meaningful in so many ways as O.J. Simpson.
Right. So first as a superstar athlete.
Transcendent
and
superstar
speaking
athlete.
Of the 1970s, which you and I both grew up in, he was...
Well, should we start talking about him? Is that right, right now?
Sure. So, right. He went to... Well, he went to junior college in San Francisco for a couple of years, transferred to USC in the late 1960s, won the Heisman Trophy in 1968, was drafted by the Buffalo Bills, had a couple of years at the beginning of his NFL career, sort of getting untracked. But by the time I came along, the first season I was sports aware was 1973.
Okay.
And I was following the NFL very closely that year. And that year, OJ, who was then 25, 26 years old, rushed for 2,000 yards.
Right, first time ever.
The first time ever was...
First time that an NFL player has ever
yeah,
done.
Yeah, had an absolutely spectacular season, culminating in his final game of the season. He rushed for 200 yards against the New York Jets.
Right.
So I remember that.
Yeah.
And was an absolutely dominant player in the NFL. The first superstar that I remember as a football fan in the 1970s.
Okay, so me too. And I became a little more aware about sports a little bit later. It's probably around 77, 78. We're getting toward the end of his career.
Yep.
But he's still on the Bills when I'm paying attention. I don't remember ever actually watching him in a game, but I remember every Monday Night Football, Howard Cosell doing the highlights from Sunday. And there was always an O.J. Simpson highlight. Always something spectacular with that great Monday Night Football music. You just watched O.J. Simpson. You hear that his nickname is The Juice. And you were just interested in
O.J. Simpson.
Yes, with the electric company as his offensive line. There was just this star magnitude about him that came across the screen, even when he's wearing a football helmet here late 1970s.
And he was already also a media sensation off the football field by then.
Well, and this is his other, and I want to keep talking about his NFL career, but this is his other great, one of his many great significances.
Yeah, right. So he becomes the first African-American pitchman of note, I think, in American television history,
Yeah, and think of all the guys who came before him, Jackie Robinson and Wilt Chamberlain.
Jim Brown,
and Bill Russell.
And
Jim Brown. But no, companies weren't comfortable linking themselves. O.J. leads, think of where we are now with Michael Jordan and LeBron James.
Yes.
This is the story that starts with O.J. Simpson.
That's right. And of course, Hertz Rental Car is the ad campaign that makes him famous. He's running through an airport.
Those were the coolest commercials in the 1970s.
Yeah, yeah.
OJ's in his three-piece suit, his briefcase, jumping over the airport chairs.
Right. And as people have reflected on, one way to make him palatable to white audiences was to have people in the airport. I saw a clip of a commercial recently.
Interesting, turning and looking.
Like,
and
well, like a like an old white lady saying, "Go, AJ, go, OJ, go," so
that
they're on his side.
But that was definitely part of the ad.
100%.
And that's the whole point, right? I mean, advertisers always said it's a white dollar, so you've got to appeal to the white people. Yep. How is a black man going to sell a rental car agency?
Yep.
And OJ did it.
All right, so we'll come back to that. So what are some of your, you said you want to talk more about his plan?
Oh, sure. Well, I want to talk about his last 2 years. Yeah. At the end of his career, he goes back to San Francisco, his hometown, and he plays for the 49ers. And this is right before the 49ers hired Bill Walsh and right before the 49ers drafted Joe Montana. Mm-hmm. The 49ers were absolutely awful. And so when people ask me about O.J. Simpson, I say, well, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I had family members who were rabid 49er fans and rabid Oakland Raider fans. They were season ticket holders for both. And I guess I was about 9 or 10, and I realized I need to make a call. I need to pick one of these teams. I can't be both. I believe very strongly that you pick a team and you stick with it the rest of your life.
As a New York fan who always had to choose between one of two franchises, I understand.
So you know the drill. So here I am in 1979, and the Raiders were pretty good back then, obviously. They won the Super Bowl.
In 77. Yep.
They've got Stabler, and they got John Madden as the coach. And I remember thinking, I'm going with the 49ers because they have O.J. Simpson, and O.J. Simpson is my favorite football player. And then O.J. Simpson retired, and like I said, we drafted Joe Montana, 5 Super Bowls in 15 years. So it all worked out in the end.
Very
so with
nicely,
that regard, I just want to say thank you, O.J. Simpson. It's because of O.J. Simpson that I'm a 49ers fan.
Yeah. So right. I think 1979 was his final season, actually. Yeah. And he had already started broadcasting on Monday Night Football.
Okay.
And was already in movies.
Well, and just being on Monday Night Football. See, when I watched Monday Night Football, I didn't know that Frank Gifford and Don Meredith were former players who I was supposed to know.
Of significance.
They were just these old white announcers. Yeah. But O.J. Simpson, to me, I didn't realize that an athlete could be an announcer also. Obviously, they can, and they continue to do so. But another one of his significances.
Yeah. So Monday Night Football, other broadcasting responsibilities on NBC and ABC, starring in movies,
and
Towering Inferno,
and the Naked Gun movies where he seemed
Capricorn,
to have a...
Capricorn 1.
I forgot Capricorn 1. Yeah, he seemed to have a sense of humor. It just seemed like everything he touched worked. And O.J. Simpson was able to, live this Los Angeles lifestyle and kind of seamlessly move between the black world and the white world, which is a lot easier to do today, less easy to do back then.
Well, he really was kind of the first in that
He's
regard.
The first crossover, I guess. I mean, there were entertainers, maybe some singers who were doing this, but athletes weren't doing this.
No.
And Jonathan, there's that famous quote. Someone asked O.J. Simpson about being black in the United States, and he responded, "I'm not black, I'm O.J." O.J. Simpson knew he was African-American, obviously, but his bigger point is, I'm not going to let these categories, these confines define me. And he really walked that walk. He was able to live that life and really kind of created a new celebrity. I don't want to say unracial culture, but it just proved that race was not going to severely limit anyone in these venues.
Yeah. So all of this, Matt, I feel like is, I think, an apt characterization of our thinking about and understanding of O.J. up to...
Yeah, up to, but he was a big, big deal before then.
No question.
Had we never heard from him again, in my sport history course, I would still be talking about the importance of O.J. Simpson in American culture.
Yeah. But I sort of said what I just said to say that narrative that we've sort of mutually constructed up to now, including about his race and racial identity, takes on a very different meaning.
There's an irony there.
Once we start talking about the events that I think most people today know O.J. for, which is the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, the trial that was the trial of the century, as many people say, reshaped American media in all sorts of ways. And one thing that we, Matt and I will each be referring to some degree is a documentary that came out in 2016, a five-part documentary that ran on ESPN and ABC called OJ Made in America by the documentarian Ezra Edelman.
Yeah.
Incidentally, the son of Marion Wright Edelman, the great civil rights leader and NAACP.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. And it's
apparently an Iowa basketball fan. Did you see him at these Iowa basketball games?
I did not.
Games,
no, I did not.
Kalen Clark
interesting.
On?
I missed that. Interesting. Yeah. So, yeah. So we'll talk more about Ezra Edelman's very interesting.
Oh, it's great.
Retelling of the OJ story. But
don't turn this podcast off now, but when it's over, go and watch that.
In my
mind, that is the best television I have ever seen.
It's certainly the best sports documentary I think it's ever been made.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there more things on television than sports documentaries? I didn't know that.
If one were thinking otherwise.
Yeah.
So Matt, but before we get to that,
because
you've said to me off the air, you kind of lived that era in the early 90s.
In Los Angeles?
Yeah, so I guess I want to...
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah,
okay, well,
yeah.
Let me walk it back a little bit. I didn't live the stories that I'm about to tell in the sense that Los Angeles is a very large, racially segregated city.
Right, but you lived in it.
But I mean, to that point, I think it's important to know, you know, so I went to UCLA and then I was living in West Los Angeles and
you graduated in 91.
91. And that's a world away from South Central and from all of these things that even though it's only 4, 5, 6 miles, it is a world away. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of incidents. And this is what the documentary does so well. Really, to understand the OJ verdict, I think you have to understand some of the things that were happening in that city first. And the two things that I think you absolutely have to understand. There is a televised murder of a 15-year-old black girl named Latasha Harlins, who goes into a grocery store owned by Korean Americans, and maybe she's shoplifting something, maybe she's not.
A bottle of orange juice.
A bottle of orange juice, yeah. And she gets into an altercation with the Korean American woman behind she lashes out, and there are a couple of punches thrown. And then the security cam captures Latasha Harlins turning and starting to walk away. And when this Korean American grocer, and I'm continuing to mention the ethnicity because it comes into play here, just shoots her in the back, grabs a gun and shoots her in the back.
And kills her.
And despite, she was convicted of, I
looked this up today. She was convicted of voluntary manslaughter.
But never served any time.
Which should have carried something like a 10 to 15 year sentence.
Yeah.
And she got 5 years probation.
5 years probation.
This is in 1991.
Yeah. And look, I'm glad I wasn't there in that moment. I realize people do things in the moment, but that seemed like a miscarriage. I mean, so that was shocking when that verdict came out. And then
the documentary
tells this story,
tells that story among others.
And a friend of mine, Brenda Stevenson at UCLA, has written a great book about this too. And then kind of places what comes next in that context. And then what just happened just a couple weeks later, actually, is the beating of Rodney King by 4 police officers. Rodney King, a black motorist who is stopped evading the police and then surrounded by police officers and beaten.
A vicious beating that went on and on and on. And he's down on the ground. He's like, he's in a crouch. And with their batons, they are wailing away at him.
They break his ankle. They break his orbital bone. He's got lacerations all over him. And that was filmed as well from a distance. And it's hard to overstate how shocking that video was. And I don't want to suggest we see video, because we see videos of stuff like this all the time now. Yeah. And it's not that we're inured to it, but that was the first one that I had ever seen.
No, I think that was a new moment in American history, that it was a crime like that was captured on tape.
On a big video camera, obviously.
Yes, right. And then became part of people's consciousness of the event.
And if you know the story, the police, Rodney King's lawyer said, my client has been beaten. The video isn't out yet. And they said, no, that's not true. And then the videotape comes out and they change their story to, well, he was resisting arrest, which if that's resisting arrest, I mean, he's just crawling for his life. So there have been all these moments that if you're reading the newspaper, if you're watching the news over the previous years where a person of color is beaten and says the police have done this and the police say absolutely not. Who do you believe? Mm-hmm. Ignorantly, I didn't know who to believe. Mm-hmm. Well, now we have proof. Yep. There it is.
Yep.
The police beat him up and they lied.
And worth emphasizing what black people in Los Angeles had been saying for decades.
That's what I'm emphasizing here. Yeah, they had been saying that. And here I am going, well, I don't know. You know, there's this side and there's this side. How do you know? Well, now we have proof. And despite that proof, those four police officers, their attorneys very skillfully had the trial moved out of Los Angeles proper to a mostly white suburb, Simi Valley, where the all-white jury found the police officers not guilty.
In 1992.
In 1992.
Which set off several days of
violence.
Violence, rioting.
Rioting. Is it the LA riots? Is it the LA rebellion? It just sort of depends on your perspective. So I was teaching at a school then. I was doing aftercare. Mm. And two things I want to say about that moment, if I may. When that verdict came out, well, I was shocked. I was watching it with my coworkers, most of them who are African-American. And I remember thinking, what? That's impossible. And they just shook their heads and they said, I knew it.
Uh-huh.
I knew they were going to.
And you were just naive.
And I was just naive. I didn't know. And they were so angry. And they were angry at me. They were angry at all white people. And I remember at the time, you know, thinking, wait, what? But I get it, right? Yeah. I mean, that was a learning moment for me. And then as the city collapsed all around us, parents were coming in just with horror on their face, you know, trying to get their children out of there, get them safe, because motorists were being dragged out of cars and beaten. And then the cops were coming and beating people up. Yeah, that was a scary moment.
So the Edelman documentary, OJ Made in America, tells the Latasha
Harlan's
story,
yep.
Tells the Rodney King story, starts with the Watts riots, rebellion, depending on your preferred terminology, in 1965 to paint a picture of decades of violence inflicted upon black Los Angeles by the police department.
Right. Or victimized by other people and not getting justice.
Yeah, correct. And all of that as the necessary context for understanding the trial, verdict, and reaction to that verdict when O.J. was prosecuted in 1994 or 1995.
And that's what I love about that show, context, you know, historical context. This does not happen in a vacuum, even though I think when it did happen at the time, not a lot of people realized that, that context.
So one of the most, I would say, striking visuals of the documentary is showing people waiting for the verdict to come in.
Yeah, well, we need to talk about just the Bronco chase first.
Okay, all right. Okay, so we'll do that.
So
yeah.
I want to hear your story about this. Where were you that day?
So I, of course, remember. It was Friday, what was it, June 17th, 1994, and I'm in front of a television set because it's game 5 of the NBA Finals, Knicks and Rockets.
And you're a Knicks fan?
The closest my team has come in half a century to
winning
an NBA championship.
Yeah.
And there's a break in the action, and I guess it was Tom Brokaw, because it was NBC, saying, you know, we're going live to Los Angeles, where O.J. Simpson, who was supposed to turn himself in, I guess, is in a white Bronco, a Ford Bronco, being
driven by his friend Al Cowling.
And so I'm going to explain why I don't know this.
Yeah.
You had already heard that O.J. Simpson was a suspect in this crime. You'd already heard of the murder of his wife.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I had.
Okay.
I knew that there had been a killings.
Yeah.
5 days before.
Okay.
I don't remember if I knew that he was supposed to turn himself in that day.
At that moment,
I don't remember.
Yeah, it was just about suspect.
But so, suspect. So I was aware that why he was on the run from the law.
Okay. And in that slow motion chase, which I have since seen, obviously, many times.
Yes, for 2 hours or whatever. I don't remember how long.
Yeah, interesting.
It was a long, slow, deeply weird event.
And then so when you're watching the game, I know they did like a picture in the picture. Which one was the big picture, the basketball game or the OJ chase?
I don't remember now, but I do remember feeling like there's no way I can focus on the game.
On the game when this is happening. This is a bigger, the point, it's a bigger deal than the NBA finals. And you're a Knicks fan.
I'm a Knicks fan, and this really mattered to me. And I'm 28 years old at the time, and it's O.J. Simpson. I mean, to your earlier point, Matt, at that time, it'd be hard to think of a bigger name to be. I mean, I suppose Michael Jordan.
Yeah, or I was going to say Michael Jackson.
Or Michael Jackson. But O.J. would be right up there.
Yeah.
You know, so,
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Well, here's my story. I was in on that day either Romania or Bulgaria backpacking through Europe with no access to a phone, couldn't do sports phone from Sophia. Uh-huh. And I'm just cruising around.
No internet to speak.
No internet. I know nothing, right? Uh-huh. I haven't seen a newspaper for probably 3 weeks.
Oh, interesting.
I get on a train and I go to Istanbul and this is so exciting. I'm going to go get a newspaper. Cause I think I wanted to know who won the NBA finals.
Okay.
And I walk into.
And is it the International Herald Tribune?
It's the International Herald Tribune is what I wanted. Yep. But I look and every single magazine on the magazine stand, I think to myself, or I said out loud, I was traveling with someone, why is O.J. Simpson's face on every single magazine cover? I had no idea this was going on. And then just read with total shock about what had happened. And I call my mother after 3 weeks, and the first thing she says isn't, are you safe? Are you okay? It's, have you heard the news about O.J. Simpson? And, no, tell me, what did I miss? Uh-huh. So I missed that important cultural moment.
Okay, so that reminds me to ask you, Matt. So after all of that, he's arrested. He's held in confinement. He's not allowed out on bail.
Right.
There's pretrial stuff in the summer of 1994. And then the trial begins, I guess, at the beginning of 1995. How closely did you follow the legal proceed? And the trial lasted 9 months.
Yeah, that's the thing. I was watching very close at first. I had just left Los Angeles and I was living in the San Francisco. No. I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area, and people were putting signs on their desk saying, this is a no OJ zone. You know, like, I don't want to talk about this.
Okay.
So I followed it very closely for a while.
Okay.
And then I just kind of got tired of it. Uh-huh. It was too much.
Uh-huh.
How about you?
So I watched one 1 hour snippet of the entire proceedings, which was pretrial. July of 1994.
Okay.
It was the day the limo driver takes the stand to say, I showed up at OJ's residence night. I rang the intercom for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then after 20 minutes, I saw some man flash across the courtyard.
Yeah.
And then 5 minutes later, OJ answers.
And this fits the police story.
Right. The limo driver takes OJ to the airport to go to Chicago to play golf in a celebrity tournament. He's got cuts on his hands, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I watched that man. I thought, it is a 100% certainty that he's guilty.
Yeah.
Do not need to
watch anymore.
And I literally did not watch another second.
Interesting.
And I was in Moscow actually when the verdict came down.
Oh,
I was at the American Embassy in October of 1995 when the verdict came in. And so that was my viewing of. So I was not a consumer.
Not a consumer of the trial.
And I got engaged that year. I was whatever. I was busy with other
stuff. Good for you, Jonathan. First of all, congratulations on your engagement back then. And good for you privileging your fiance over the O.J. Simpson
trial.
There
you go. So,
Okay. So I said I wasn't following it. And I know some people were, because some people were just watching every single second of it. But I was paying attention to it.
Yeah.
I lost a friend over this trial, actually. Mm. And in hindsight, I think this is a story worth telling because it gives you a sense of how everyone was kind of locked into their positions, right?
Yeah.
And I had a friend who just looked at this from the perspective of Nicole Brown Simpson, someone who would clearly been battered by O.J. Simpson.
Multiple times.
Multiple times. We saw the pictures. I just recently reheard her 911 call once when O.J. Simpson, and it was just
I listened to that also in the last
chilling.
Week.
It's yeah, terrible. And you yep. just, you can hear the total horror in her voice and yes. her fear. Like the system failed her 100%.
Utterly and profoundly. Yep, yes.
Yep.
Yes.
And so my friend, her name is Emily, saw that story through her perspective, and she wanted vengeance. She wanted justice for her. I saw the trial differently. I didn't come at it from the perspective of an O.J. Simpson fan. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh no, I yeah. love O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Like when, you know, other athletes have committed crimes, people rally behind them. It was none of that. I just came at it from the perspective of, okay, let's look at the evidence. A lot of that evidence came from that police detective, Mark Furman.
Yes, who well, we can, yeah.
Who it yes. turns out yes. was a liar.
Yeah.
And well, I don't know if he's a racist or not a racist, but he uttered the N-word many times.
And lied about it on the stand.
And lied about that. So I was just
the
thinking,
only conviction in the O.J. trial to come out of the O.J. trial was Mark Furman for perjury.
I forgot that. Yeah, well, that wraps this up, right? That's what I'm saying. That's an indictment on the LAPD. That is your lead detective, a lying racist.
Yes.
How can you believe any of the evidence that comes in this case? That was my point of view. And yes. so, Emily, I just said, look, I'm convinced he's guilty. I just don't think a jury should find him guilty because the whole case is tainted. And we went back and forth and we argued and we argued and we stopped being friends.
Wow.
Over
wow.
it. I mean, that's how emotional all this was.
It's interesting, Matt. I'm thinking through your framing, which is close to mine, but my conclusion was different, I think, at the time, which was he should have been convicted because he did it. He slaughtered two people
yes.
in cold blood. But I very much felt like or thought we can hold two truths. One is he did it. Mm-hmm. There's no question.
Right.
And two, there was terrible police malfeasance.
Yes.
And prosecutorial yes. misconduct.
Yes.
And the lead detective, I mean, I said this at the time. I'm only sort of characterizing what I said at the time. I'm not. What I would say to people is, look, if you want to convict O.J. Simpson, don't make a neo-Nazi your yeah. lead investigator.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
So.
And then when... If you're African-American and you're on the jury and you hear those accusations that are backed up by the tape about that lead detective, and you've just lived through Rodney King and those police officers getting off and Latasha Harlan's, her murderer not being convicted.
And the entire history, your whole life experience, right?
Because undoubtedly every Black person in Los Angeles has a story like that,
yep.
right? Has some sort of misdealing with the police.
Yep.
It's in that larger context that this verdict is announced.
Right. So one of the striking visuals of the documentary, and I'm sure people have seen this in other contexts too, is reaction shots as people are waiting for the verdict.
Oh, yeah.
And again, to... be clear about the magnitude of this event. Everybody is watching this on a television set somewhere in public spaces.
I was.
In dorms, in restaurants,
yeah.
On the street with the television set up out there.
So you were in right. Moscow?
So I was in Moscow at the U.S. Embassy.
Walk me through this.
Well, so I'll tell you. So I was in Moscow. I was visiting my buddy Lanny. And his girlfriend was working in D.C. and they were emailing each other.
Okay.
And she, so it's 8 o'clock at night because I think the verdict came down at 1 o'clock Eastern time.
Wait, they had email then? States.
We had email.
Okay. Did I have email? I don't think I had.
I don't know. But
yeah, I'm not sure I did.
So they are emailing with each other and there's a bunch of us like in the office and Lanny's like, oh, wait a minute. The verdict's coming in.
Oh, wow.
And so his girlfriend is emailing him. What's happening?
All right. So here's this global story.
Yeah. So, and then he says not guilty. And we're all like, oh,
yeah. Know? Yeah.
But to go back to those reaction shots, if you are watching reaction shots of Black spaces, there is, Ezra Edelman shows, jubilation.
Jubilation. Yeah.
I mean, like moon landing, you know, end of World War II, you know, and then White Space is this like shock and horror. And a buddy of mine, Orr, who lived in LA in the early 90s also, we were just talking about this last week. He said that was, and he's our age, he said that was the first time I really understood how we are living in two different Americas.
Yeah, again, for me, I think it was that Rodney King moment that I talked about, but this was one of them as well. I was at UC Berkeley then and went into the student union and watched it with about 250 students. It was both a black, white, and an Asian space. I mean, there were a lot of different people there. And when the verdicts came out, the African-American students exploded. And just over there across my other shoulder, young white women just started sobbing. They broke into tears. And so that gives you a sense of how, you know, this became about everything, this trial. It was so much more than just that particular moment.
And just to reflect on that for another minute, the trial was so much about race, because that was the defense team's strategy.
Yeah, the guy who says he's not black, he's OJ, was defended as another black victim in Los Angeles.
Right, and this comes back to a thread we started earlier, Matt, that OJ, according to OJ Made in America, wasn't just a crossover star, sort of disavowed his blackness.
Yeah.
Wanted to be accepted by white society.
White wife, white neighborhood, whether that's disavowing blackness.
That, I feel like that was a portrayal.
Yeah, that was the
And then
the
when this murder takes place, he and his defense team adopt a very particular strategy, which is to make this as much about, to prosecute the LA Police Department for racism.
Yes.
And one very striking story that the documentary tells that I reminded myself of this week. There's a day during the trial when the jury takes a field trip.
I think I know the story you're going to tell. I remember when this happened.
And they go to the house he was living at the time at Rockingham Drive, I guess.
Yeah.
And before they get there, the defense team rearranges.
They curate the walls,
the decor.
Yes.
The walls were filled with pictures of OJ with the people he was closest to, who were overwhelmingly white people.
Yeah.
They take down most of those photographs.
Some of these photographs are of like girlfriends of his and they're scantily clad.
Yes, that's right. So they take down most of those photographs. Yeah. They replace those photographs with photographs of OJ with black people who, according to one of his key defense attorneys, Carl Douglas himself, said, these are probably, I'm not even sure he knew who the people were in these photographs. They borrow the famous artwork of Norman Rockwell.
Of Ruby Bridges.
Of Ruby Bridges.
Yep, that's the
from
what
Johnny
I remember.
Cochran's wall in his office, and they put it on. So, I mean, they were.
They turn him into a civil rights activist.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's brilliant on their part. How is that allowed to happen?
How is that allowed?
Would it have even mattered? I don't know.
And, you know, you will hear somebody like Carl Douglas say, this was the big leagues. They, meaning white America, played dirty all the time.
You know, and that's a great point. And got away with stuff like this all the time.
And he didn't say this, but OJ happened to have the resources.
Yeah.
To buy a defense like that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, think of not just white people as individuals, but as owners of businesses and corporations polluting black neighborhoods and dumping toxins into this neighborhood or that neighborhood. Yeah, this is the big time.
Yeah.
We just played your game.
Yes. And I want to be clear about where I'm coming from, especially now. Over time, I have only become more sickened by the fact that he got off.
Yeah.
And in part because of just the vicious brutality with which he treated Nicole and the way that that whole set of issues, meaning violence against women, was just so easily
set to the side
and made secondary. And as I get older, you and I both have daughters in their 20s and, you know, I'm not making excuses for how I've thought about this stuff before, but that part of it now is the thing that it turns my stomach. Actually.
Yeah. And again, I still hold to the, I think the jury did the right thing, legally speaking, for the reasons we discussed.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about all of these hot button trials, and this isn't a criminal trial, but the Clarence Thomas trial that was more or less at the same time.
1991.
Where the race card, you know, play in the race card. This is where this phrase comes from. Yes. There was so much going on in American culture at that time.
Yes.
Well, and then, you know, to start to wrap up, what are your thoughts on O.J. after that moment?
So I was saying this to, I mentioned it to you and Kyle a little bit before airtime today. I did, after all these years, I watched this interview that Judith Regan, the publishing impresario, did with OJ in 2006. He wanted to write a book. He'd been paid a big advance to write a book called OJ If I Did It.
But wouldn't all of that money have gone to the Goldman family based on the civil trial?
So yes.
Okay.
I mean, he got an advance, which apparently for whatever reason they couldn't touch.
They couldn't touch. Got it.
And then the book got embroiled in legal stuff. The Goldmans took over the book.
Yeah.
The interview was embargoed for many years and was shown in pieces on CNN years later. Huh. And I watched it
last
week. Matt, it's so chilling. I mean, it's a confession by OJ. There's really no other way to say it. But an absolutely remorseless confession.
Yeah.
So I'm partly answering your question now by saying, when you ask me what I think now, it's hard for me to think about anything else than that.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go in a different direction.
Yeah.
For me, it's that next criminal trial that he's involved in Las Vegas. Where, and to be honest, I kind of forget all of the details, but he had some autographed memorabilia and jerseys that he thought were his, and someone else thought they were theirs. And he comes into a room and says,
"No." With a couple of guys.
Who had guns. Yeah. And I guess at the moment in which he says, "No one is getting out of here until I get what I want," it has just become kidnapping.
Yes.
And so he's put in prison. What was the sentence?
He was sentenced to 9 to 33 years in jail.
For going to retrieve his memorabilia, as he saw it.
And he spent the minimum time, I'm putting minimum
in
here,
quotes. Years in jail.
He spent 9 years in jail.
For that.
And Gil Garcetti, of all people.
Who was the district attorney.
The district attorney for Los Angeles and was, I don't think has ever gotten over that OJ got off. I saw an interview with Gil Garcetti a few years ago in which he said, "I have no sympathy for OJ Simpson," but essentially that was a ridiculous sentence. And I felt that way too, Matt, by the way, when he went to jail for that.
It made no sense.
Come on. I mean,
it was clearly makeup for the other one.
It was clearly makeup.
It had to be.
And it had to be. Yeah. And I don't want our justice system to be that.
I mean, maybe that's the line that runs through all of this. At every step of the way, we've talked about 5 or 6 trials now. The wrong decision was made every single
time. That is so right on.
Yeah. Yep. And that was just put in prison for 9 years for that.
Yeah.
It's not how it's supposed
to
work.
And I'll say one more thing about our justice system that I remember feeling very much at the time of the verdict was, we're talking about race. What we're not talking enough about is, if you are rich, you buy your way out of trouble
you
in the United
States. Yeah.
This is a well-established fact. There are no rich people on death row in the United States. You never get that far if you're wealthy. You buy your way out of
you
that.
Buy your way out. You buy your dream team like O.J. Simpson did,
exactly.
The Kennedys did here and there.
Yeah. And again, I mean, you know, I'll just to repeat one more time what we've been talking about. This is the one instance where a black man was rich enough to buy his way out of justice.
Yeah. Right? And so is it the specifics of the trial that shocked people and made people so angry, or was it that? No, that's not how the system is supposed to work here that made so many people.
So
we know that it made so many people happy as well.
Yeah.
A really intense, interesting time in the American past. And when I read the news last week, I think I gasped. Mm-hmm. He's one of these people. I mean, of course he was going to die soon. I hadn't even, been doing the math, but he's one of these people that were so meaningful in so many ways that it just really hit me hard.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Anything else we want to say about that or?
No, not that I'm crying a tear for O.J. Simpson. Yeah. I want to make that clear. Yeah. I kind of like, you know, what Ron Goldman's father said when he heard the news, like, so what? You know, I mean, I'm not saying so what because he's so meaningful in so many ways, but
No, and I suppose now I do feel compelled to say, right, Nicole Brown Simpson was, of course, murdered that night, and so was Ron Goldman, who was returning
a pair of glasses.
A pair of glasses happened to be a waiter at a restaurant she'd eaten at that evening.
Who knows the whole story? Doesn't matter, right? Doesn't matter. All right. Well, thanks to our listeners for listening to us kind of work through this and process this this very significant person.
Yep. So this has been another episode of the Agony of Defeat podcast. Please be sure to listen to us wherever you find your podcast. And as always, we want to thank our awesome international team, Kyle and Samantha, for helping make this happen. And until next time.